From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember the great mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, who died earlier this week. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz offers an appreciation, and we listened back to a 1996 interview with her. Also, Dave Chappelle. Before he walked away from his hit Comedy Central show, he completed enough material for three more installments. Those so-called lost episodes will be shown for the first time beginning on Sunday. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Many music lovers have called mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson the most extraordinary singer of our time. She died of cancer on Monday at the age of 52. We'll listen back to an interview Terry did with Lorraine Hunt in 1996, before she married composer Peter Lieberson. But first, we have an appreciation from our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, who says her death, at the very height of her powers, is devastating.
Lorraine Hunt Lieberson seemed to have everything. Her sumptuous voice could turn from blue velvet to molten gold. Few singers have ever matched her uncanny ability to enter the spirit of whatever music she sang, to reveal the soul of every character she played, to draw every listener in. She went from triumph to triumph, yet never became a diva, never lost her sense of purpose or her sense of humor about herself. I was lucky to hear her from the beginning of her vocal career, especially in the famous Mozart and Handel productions staged by Peter Sellers, as well as with the Boston Symphony and in leading roles at the Met. As Dido, Queen of Carthage, in Berlioz's epic opera The Trojans, she achieved a truly tragic stature. She was such a regal presence that her suicide when Aeneas deserts her was all the more heartbreaking. As Carmen, a role she sang only once in Boston, she was a scintillating, charismatic, complicated heroine, not a hip-swinging cliché. Strikingly beautiful and sexy, she also excelled in so-called trouser roles. In Handel's Julius Caesar, she played the vengeful son of the assassinated Roman leader Pompey. Her ferocity was terrifying. She never held back. Yet her singing was always magnificent, with pitch-perfect accuracy even in the most astounding coloratura, and that remarkable, indrawing tonal beauty. She was originally a viola player, then started singing as a soprano, but her voice settled more comfortably into the mezzo-soprano range. Her dark, rich timbre and seamless phrasing even sounded like a viola. This aria from a Bach cantata, conducted by her friend Craig Smith, is a lullaby sung by the sufferer to weary eyes that have grown tired of the world.
Ooh.
One of her most recent appearances was with the Boston Symphony in the gorgeous Neruda Songs, a series of love songs composed for her by her husband, Peter Lieberson, a work that was a finalist for last year's Pulitzer Prize. Hearing her sing these songs with such passionate intensity and intimacy, you couldn't imagine how seriously ill she must have been. Lately, her cancellations made almost as much news as her performances. It's understandable. What could be more disappointing than missing someone you wanted to hear so badly? Like the beloved British contralto Kathleen Ferrier, who died too young half a century ago, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson's star was still rising, and we wanted her to go on forever.
Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz remembering mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, who died on Monday at the age of 52. In 1996, she spoke with Terry Gross. Terry asked her how she began performing as a singer.
I was playing viola, one of my gigs in the Bay Area, where I'm from, San Francisco Bay Area. And Kent Nagano had recently become the director of the Berkeley Symphony, and I was principal viola there. And he had this really wild idea to do the opera Hansel and Gretel and take it to prisons. And my parents had both been involved in opera, and my father a director and my mother a singer, and so I had been in productions myself as a, you know, as a child. I had been at one of the Gingerbread Children in Hansel and Gretel, and so I knew the opera well. And I said, "Oh, I know that opera. I was a gingerbread kid. I could do the role of Hansel, the mezzo role." And he said, "Okay." So this was after, you know, many years of not singing or not, you know, sort of seriously studying or anything. And we did this cut-up, edited version of Hansel and Gretel, and we took it to San Quentin Prison. And we didn't have much of an audience, but they did seem to be appreciative and, you know, wanted our phone numbers afterwards. that's terrible.
Not a big turnout for opera in the prison?
No. I don't know. I guess the publicity hadn't been very thorough or something. And also, we had to put together our costumes because, you know, it was just all very low budget. So I just wore some, you know, pants that I cut off at the knee, and I couldn't figure out how to flatten my chest out. So I just wore a, you know, a flannel shirt, and I was supposed to be a boy, Hansel, and I had very long hair, and I found a wig at the Salvation Army, stuck it on my head. So after the show at San Quentin, I took the wig off, and we're walking. We had to walk through the yard, the open yard, where to leave. And as we're walking through the yard, I heard this guy say to another guy at a little bit of a distance, I heard him say, "I thought that was a dude with a big ass." And I took it as a great compliment because I thought that, you know, with that wig and my flannel shirt, I'd been completely unconvincing as a boy. But I guess it wasn't so bad. So
well, that's really funny because, you know, a lot of the opera roles that mezzo sopranos get are male roles in early operas.
Yeah,
the roles that used to be sung by castrati.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, thank God for
I guess the guys in prison didn't realize that.
Yeah. Thank God for some of these, the period costumes that, you know, where they have the big coats and everything. It helps disguise my curves. but anyway, that was sort of what got me back into singing.
What an unconventional door back into singing.
It was, and I remember on the bus back, people were talking about the Met auditions. And I said, I should do the Met auditions. So I entered the Met auditions that year And that's sort of, I really got back into singing.
So when you started singing again, you knew you were a mezzo?
No, I went, I was singing soprano then when I went back to school.
Why? Because the opera that got you back, Hansel and Gretel, you were singing mezzo in that. You were singing lower.
Well, the teachers and people that were hearing me sing, I remember at the Met auditions after that, Hansel, I auditioned as a mezzo, and a lot of the judges said, you're not a mezzo, you're a soprano. And granted, I hadn't taken lessons for years. I just sort of went into the auditions, cold. And when I first went to the conservatory, they were my teacher and, you'll be a Countess in Figaro and...
The roles are better for sopranos?
No, it wasn't. It was just where my voice was centered at that time. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it just kept settling a little lower and lower, and now it's
low.
I say, well, now I also have this cold, which is making it a little lower, but it... I like to say I've now settled into my viola voice.
Now, what's the difference between a mezzo-soprano and a soprano in the range?
It's, obviously a soprano generally sings higher, but it's mostly about where the center of the voice lies is what determines, what would determine a soprano and mezzo. I mean, there's mezzos that can sing... quite high. I mean, a lot of mezzos have no trouble with the top. It's more about where the voice is centered, and it's generally lower than a soprano.
Now, when you're a mezzo-soprano, do you get a lot of male roles, the roles that had originally been written for castrati?
Yeah, I seem to be suited for them, as I say. Not
suited, no pun intended.
Not necessarily... body type-wise, mm-hmm. But there's some kind of, my male energy is kicks right in when I'm doing these roles, and it seems to work well. I really enjoy it. I love the gender-bending aspects of what I do and getting to play men and women and girls and boys, and I love that.
Lorraine Hunt Lieberson speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1996 interview with mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, who died Monday at the age of 52.
When you decided to actually become a singer and you went back and started studying again, were there parts of your range that you weren't yet comfortable in and that you really had to develop? And if so, how did you develop it?
Well, the top was always a problem. When I first started singing again, especially since I was trying to sing soprano. So it was never easy. I just had a lot of tension and, I think it had a lot to do with my breath and all the other stuff that was in the way, technical tensions and holding. And so even though my voice is centered lower now, the top is easier, mm-hmm. So, and the bottom of my voice has opened up too, which has been a great, great kind of discovery for me in the last few years. Where the bottom is really filled out, and it's it just feels like this great foundation, which then allows the top to be freer. And when I was first singing as a soprano, I had a teacher who sort of scared me off singing, exploring my chest voice, which is the low part of the voice. So I never used it, and you know, I suppose there were some good reasons for that, but now it's a great new part of my voice that makes it feel complete.
Well, it's, I think, one of the things that's so distinctive about your voice is that chest voice, the deeper tones.
Mm.
Can you show us the difference between, you know, a chest voice and the higher voice?
Okay, here's a little chest voice. Deep river. Oh, that's really low. Deep river. That's chest voice. My home is over Jordan, deep river, Lord. I want to cross over into campground.
Well, that's quite lovely.
So, I didn't really go way up, but haven't warmed up today.
Do you ever have trouble crossing over in a phrase from the chest voice to the head voice? You know, if a phrase is crossing that line.
Yeah, sometimes.
Was that a barrier you had to overcome when you were training?
Not really. It never was a big problem, but every once in a while there'll be a phrase that's written in a certain way that you know, maybe goes right on the break. And the break in my voice is becoming less and less, but it tends to be around middle C, where middle C is a note for me that sometimes goes easily into chest voice and sometimes it wants to stay mixed in with the middle register. So, you know, depending on the piece and what the phrase is, sometimes it you know, wants to, it doesn't know which way to go.
Mm-hmm. No, I think the person who gave you your first really big professional break as a singer was the director Peter Sellers, who cast you in a production of Handel's Julius Caesar,
yeah.
Yes?
He and Craig Smith, who was the music director.
Mm-hmm. Was it a different experience for you doing a male role in contemporary drag as opposed to, you know, doing it in a period costume in the clothes of a man?
Well, yeah, I did obsess about having to wear pants on stage, which, you know, modern dress. I was very self-conscious, you know, about showing my legs because that, I mean, it was just a little, in a period costume, the pants are either, you know, knee pants and they're kind of baggy and you have a coat that, you know, covers your thighs and all that. But I just felt a little more exposed. But Dunja Romakova did a great job in the costuming there. So it was a little nerve-wracking. And of course then you always have to, they have to make this special binders, we call them, to go under the shirt to flatten you out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a challenge, too.
It's be pretty uncomfortable.
But, well, that's the challenge, is getting it to really look right.
Well, here's what I can't figure out. I mean, you have to breathe really deeply when you're singing. You have to have a lot of freedom in your body so your lungs can expand. Now, if you have something binding your bosom, how can you get the breath that you need?
Well, that's the trick, is to get, you know, they have to use some kind of stretchy material and that'll just be enough holding in and still not encumber me.
Well, I have one last question for you. Do you find that singing is any more or less enjoyable now that you've been doing it professionally for a long time as opposed to the period before you became a professional singer when you just sang for pleasure?
I'd have to say generally it's immensely satisfying, and I get a great deal of joy from it. Just the act of singing is, for me, you know, especially when I'm feeling well and my voice is just feeling free and soaring, it's a wonderful, invigorating, you know, healing experience, even just for me personally. And every now and then, like from my past when I used to sing in a choir every Sunday and do Bach cantatas, just, making music is just one of the highest things for me.
Lorraine Hunt, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Lorraine Hunt Lieberson speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. The celebrated mezzo-soprano died Monday at the age of 52. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dave Chappelle. He once described his Comedy Central show as America's number one source for offensive comedy. Before he walked away from the show, he recorded enough material for 3 new episodes, and they're now being shown for the first time. Also, David Edelstein reviews Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli.
I don't think he's coming.
Oh. Let's start the show.
The comedy career of Dave Chappelle hasn't exactly been the model of conformity. His Comedy Central sketch series, Chappelle's Show, started out as a modest success, but exploded when it was released on DVD. The first season sold close to 3 million copies, an amazingly high number. Not only was it the most popular TV series on DVD ever released, beating even The Simpsons, but more people actually watched it on DVD than on television. By the end of season two, Chappelle was so hot that Comedy Central made him an offer he couldn't refuse. More than $50 million in exchange for two more seasons' worth of TV shows and DVDs. But after filming a handful of new sketches, Chappelle reconsidered the offer and did refuse. Last April, just a month before the third season of Chappelle's show was set to launch, he quit his own show, disappeared for a while in Africa, and returned to announce on Oprah Winfrey's show that it wasn't in his heart to come back. Comedy Central, after waiting in vain more than a year for Chappelle to return, has taken the skits he filmed before his vanishing act and cobbled them into three new installments. Called Chappelle's Show, The Lost Episodes, they're hosted by Chappelle's former co-stars, Charlie Murphy and Donnell Rawlings, and begin this Sunday. Many of the sketches are about how much money Chappelle was making as a TV comedy star. Here's a taste from Sunday's show. Chappelle is in the Caribbean getting an $8 haircut when news comes over the TV about his lucrative new contract.
So, you go on do your show again?
It's looking that way.
You must be paid. Big TV star.
Nah, man, it's cable. I do all right, but nothing to write home about.
Congratulations to Dave Chappelle! He's raking it in on the new season of the Chappelle Show, the Dave Chappelle Show. Reports say Chappelle has received $55 million.
They lying like on TV, don't they?
All right, you all set.
How much I owe you, man?
$11,000.
Terry Gross spoke with Dave Chappelle in 2004 during the second and last full season of his show.
You said in one episode of your show that after someone complained to you that your show was offensive to black people, and that person, by the way, was white, you came up with this idea for a game show called I Know Black People.
I Know Black People!
Welcome to the show, I Know Black People. We take contestants who claim to know black people and put their knowledge of African-American culture to the test. The contestant who answers the most questions, of course, wins our grand prize. Let's bring them out one at a time now. Our first contestant is a professor of African-American studies and history at Fordham University, the New York City police officer, is a writer for such black television shows as The Chris Rock Show and Chappelle Show. Okay, our next contestant works in a Korean grocery store, is a DJ, and claims to have many black... How can black people rise up and overcome?
How can they rise up and overcome? Well, can they overcome?
That is correct.
Reparations.
That is acceptable.
This is a rap lyric?
No, this is, I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a general
this is
question.
An actual question.
All right. There's a complex answer there.
That is correct.
Staying alive.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, stop cutting each other's throat.
That also is correct. How can black people rise up and overcome?
Get out and vote.
That is incorrect. I'm sorry.
Dave Chappelle, that's such a funny idea for a show. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in the writing of the sketch, like what it was like to put this sketch together?
Originally, we were going to write the material. We were going to write it like an actual sketch. And when we sat down and started to write it, it was one of these things where it's like, this would be better if we got actual people and just quizzed them. And we just came up with questions. We just had them put
You actually
the set
got
together.
Real people. You got like a white cop.
All those people were real. We had them get us a police officer, get us a Korean grocer, get us a black dude.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, it was completely authentic. And then all the hosting elements were just like, as far as those were like off the cuff, you know. But the answers were incredible, man. The things that these people were saying. One of the things, they're going to see me, so they kind of go for being funny, but all of them were really nervous, and they were all kind of afraid that I was making fun of them. And then once we got to shooting, I think everyone just kind of relaxed and kind of unwound. And I don't know, that's one of my favorite sketches we've done.
Now, you're really funny at doing white people. And I think, like, when you're white, you don't think of there being, like, a white accent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when I hear you do it, I realize, okay, there's definitely, like, a white accent. So what do you do when you do white?
I take the rhythm out of my voice. I try to keep it monotone and even. But again, all right, see, I do these things. But I'm not really, it's almost like sometimes I'll watch old movies and how they portray black people, you know, with like Step and Fetch It and all these things. I remember watching them and something in the movie made me laugh and they were like, why are you laughing at that? And it's not that I'm laughing at black people as much as I'm laughing at the way black people were perceived. Like, this is what they actually thought about black people, which just seems ridiculous to me.
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, when I do that, I think, again, it's not malicious. And it's not necessarily what I think of white people. It's just a funny character of what, you know, what the world looks like through my eyes.
Is there a particular person you conjure up when you do a white man?
Not a particular. It's a composite. It's a composite character.
Of who?
It's funny, man. All right. You know, when I was growing up in D.C., in particular, this isn't true for me personally, but there's a lot of black people that I know who really had never had any personal experience with white people, mm-hmm. which is weird to think about in this day and time. But D.C. is a predominantly black city, and because of the economic situation and whatever, they just didn't have any contact with white people outside of being authority figures. Officer, Your Honor, you know, if it's a teacher or a principal, but it's always some kind of authority figure. So there's this whole, you know, their experience with across the color line normally happened via television or, you know, or something where you're dealing with an authority figure. So I, on the other hand, you know, my parents were split up. My mom was living in D.C. My dad was living in Ohio. I traveled to both places, so I was in the nation's capital on one end. I was in the heartland of America on another. So, you know, I just culturally, I kind of absorbed a lot. I don't know, man. I got a pretty good understanding about the culture. I think that all these differences are just cultural things.
Dave Chappelle speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with Dave Chappelle. It was recorded midway through the second season, what turned out to be the final full season, of Comedy Central's Chappelle's Show.
Now, you grew up in different neighborhoods because, I guess this was because of your parents' divorce. If I understand correctly, you grew up in Silver Springs, Maryland, Yellow Springs, Ohio, because your father was teaching at Antioch College, which is located there, and Washington, D.C. You went to schools in these different places, too?
Yeah, I did elementary school in Silver Springs, middle school in Ohio, and high school in Washington.
Were you almost part of, like, different cultures in those different places? Were there different ways of, like, dressing and different music that your friends listened to, depending on which place it was, whether it was the suburbs or the city or Ohio or Washington?
I think elementary school was more integrated because, you know, people were younger. They mixed freely with black kids, white kids. Everybody was, you know, there was no real racial hangups in elementary school. And people weren't really clothes conscious because we were young. And then by the time I got to middle school in Ohio, that's when, you start seeing alligators on people's sweater, and people start getting into like status symbols and stuff. And that was the first time where I really started like, hey man, I'm poor. And like, we don't have any money, do we? And then when I got to high school, so then I started getting into clothes, then I go to high school, and you know, I was gone during middle school. Crack came out while I was gone. So I saw like the before and after picture. I had to piece the crack epidemic together. Like I remember my first day of high school, and they were like, all right, look, if you have a pager on in school, then there's immediate grounds for suspension, because we all know what that means. I was in the back like, I don't know what that means. And then, of course, I figured out that. And then I was also trying to figure out how everyone had all this, like, gold and expensive stuff. And then I was like, oh, okay, everybody's selling drugs. You know, the crack epidemic was crazy, man. And I think a lot of the stuff that I did in my act, just coming from Ohio and then going straight back to D.C. during the crack epidemic, I think that all the inequities were just underlined.
So how did you change as you changed environments?
It's funny, man. When I was in Ohio, I was the first, like, real confident period of my life. Like, I started gaining confidence because for these kids, I was this outsider, and I had to make friends. And that was when I got, like, this huge reputation. Everyone was like, this guy's really funny. I remember in middle school, everyone was just like, this guy Dave is so hilarious. Then when I got to high school and the crack epidemic was out, you know, what it took to be popular during that, I just wasn't willing to do.
Which was what?
You know, sell drugs.
Like, right.
If you didn't have money, you couldn't get the girl you wanted, you know. It was a crack epidemic. Selling drugs was like a legitimate job in the high school I was going to. And all around D.C., it was like girls like drug dealers because they had money. I wasn't willing to be that. But it was kind of like that context kind of isolated me initially. And then when I started doing stand-up, it was like I thrived all over again.
So when you started doing stand-up and you were still in high school? 14. Okay, in Washington. What were the jokes about? What was the humor about?
The first act, Jesse Jackson was running for president, so I used to do jokes about that.
Like what?
I used to talk about stuff I saw on TV, like Alf. But they all had race in them, one way or another. Obviously, Jesse Jackson jokes don't have some racial in them. Alf, my whole thing was like the alien comes 3 billion miles from space and gets a home with the white family. It was the paradox in that joke. Which all sounds corny now, but remember, I was 14, so it was like, wow, you know.
So who were your audiences then?
All right, in those days in Washington, again, remember, this is a majority black city. There was no black comedy clubs. And I remember club owners saying things like, we'll never put more than one black person on a show because it offends the audience. I've heard all these things in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was pretty exclusive. There was one point where they actually had a rule that there was no more cursing on our stage. Which is like, this is in 88. And one of the comics who was black, this is pretty funny, he's like, look, man, he said, I curse. He said, black people use profanity because we live a profane lifestyle. And then he said something that I can't say on the radio. So he's basically like, if you see a roach crawling up the wall, you're not going to be like, golly gee, look at the roaches. You're going to be like, look at this motherfucking roach. You know, you're just gonna go for it. I know you're going to cut that out, but it was really funny, though. But just the fact, thinking back on it, the fact that there was all these limitations and all these weird issues that these club owners had, in one way, maybe prepared me for television.
I want to ask you another question about having grown up in three different places, suburban Maryland, suburban Ohio, and Washington, D.C.
Rural Ohio.
Rural
suburban
Ohio.
Suburban Maryland, rural Ohio, and Washington.
Okay, so that exposes you to different people, different cultures, different kind of geographic landscapes, different ways of living. And I'm wondering if that helped give you the ability to kind of stand back and look at people and see what was kind of funny and ridiculous and absurd about all of us. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like you have that gift of just looking back and standing outside and looking at everyone and seeing seeing some pretty funny things about us all.
Yeah, because most of the people that are stereotyped, I know the people that the stereotypes are based off of. Like, personally, I've met people like this. You know, I can remember friends of mine growing up, like, we used to all play football after school and be like, it's four of us was black, two of us was Vietnamese, was a Jewish guy from the Deep South. It was an eclectic group, you know, but we all got along. We all, you know, were friends. In the household I grew up in, my parents were somewhat, I don't know how to explain it, but over our mantelpiece, there was pictures of Malcolm X. You know, I listened to Dick Gregory records growing up. I listened to The Last Poets. I mean, you know, there were books all over the house and always reading stuff. You know, like people like Frederick Douglass, these guys' pictures were on my walls when I was growing up.
You described your family growing up as the broke Huxtables.
Yeah, we were like broke Huxtables.
Your mother was a Unitarian minister?
She was, yeah. She was, I believe she was the first black woman ordained in that Unitarian church.
And your father was a music professor?
Yeah.
What kind of music?
Voice. He used to sing opera and stuff.
So your family was really very educated and probably instilled those values in you. Was there pressure on you to do well in school and what you really wanted was to be a comic?
I mean, first of all, I was a horrible student. My parents, you know, my dad was very philosophical about these kind of things. As a matter of fact, I'm the first person in my family not to go to college, like since slavery. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, didn't like that at all. She, at first, because I was 17, I'm like, I'm not going to college. I'm going to move to New York and try to make it in stand-up. And she kind of flipped out. She was like, it's a dream of mine. This is a heavy guilt trip. She goes, it's a dream of mine to see all of my grandbabies graduate from college before I die. It's like, why you got to bring Diane up, Nana? That's a lot of pressure. But then my dad's whole take on it was, unless you want to do something that requires you go to college, then college could very well be a waste of your time.
And he was a college professor, so coming from him, that must have really registered on you.
Yeah, he was an educated man. And I think my parents ultimately wanted me to be happy. You know, I mean, my argument was, you know, Dad, if you're making a teacher's salary, yes. If I can make a teacher's salary doing stand-up, to me, I'd rather do that than teach. It's like, and he understood where I was coming from. Like, you know, it's like I didn't necessarily have to be rich and famous. Obviously, I wanted to, but that wasn't necessarily my aim. I just really, 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 to this day, I really like doing stand-up.
Since you started when you were so young, your mother did she have to or did she just want to come to the clubs with you? Was that required as like an official chaperone because you were underage?
Originally, she had to. Once everyone started knowing me, this was kind of like our routine. We'd meet down at the club. I'd be coming from school. She'd be coming from work. It was cool, man. It was like a good way to spend time together. And then at a certain age, like maybe a year into it, you know, she'd get tired at night. We'd both burn the candle both ends, but I'd always want to go, so she just let me go. And you know, not until I'm an adult, then she tells me how scary that was for her.
In what way?
You know, I mean, she tells stories like she'd hear gunshots in the middle of the night. And, you know, she went, oh, my God, it's my baby. All right. I mean, remember, this is D.C. during the crack epidemic. But I guess in her mind, it's like of all the bad things that my child could be doing, he just wants to tell jokes at these clubs. And it was a controlled environment for me. It's not like the bartender's going to give me drinks. I'm 14. It's, you know, everyone kind of looked out for me. It wasn't like I saw stuff going on, but not really. It was really goal-oriented time I was spending there.
Well, Dave Chappelle, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
All right, no problem. It was good to meet you.
Dave Chappelle speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. Skits he filmed before leaving Comedy Central are being showcased in a new miniseries, Chappelle's Show, The Lost Episodes, beginning this Sunday. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie. This is Fresh Air. Inspired by a ride at Disney World, Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, was a surprise blockbuster in 2003. It grossed close to $500 million and won an Oscar nomination for Johnny Depp, a rare honor for a comic lead performance. Virtually the same cast and crew returns for Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
There ought to be an SOB club for leading male actors. That's Sons of Brando. And it wouldn't be for the generation that emulated his method triumphs in A Streetcar Named Desire or On the Waterfront. It would be for actors who emulate late Brando, that is, weird Brando, who toy with their lines and make you laugh at their mannerisms, the method clowns. The president would be Johnny Depp, who worked with his idol in the movie Don Juan DeMarco. And because Brando played the shrink and Depp the patient, Depp got to model his weirdness for the master. I hope Brando got to see the first Pirates of the Caribbean in a gonzo effeminacy contest with Brando's Fletcher Christian in Mutiny on the Bounty. Depp's pirate captain Jack Sparrow would win, and I say that with awe. In Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, Depp has a riotous entrance I won't spoil, but this time there's no sense of discovery. An actor like Depp isn't suited to sequels. He should be out looking for new realms of looniness to conquer. Still, there's nothing quite like his Jack Sparrow. His eyes are rimmed like a glam rocker's, his gait a tipsy tiptoe through the tulips. The campy gag is that the more conventional buccaneer stereotypes treat him as they would any other pirate captain, instead of a mincing nut bird. It's a great joke, and it has to be, because the film is more than 2.5 hours. It's loosely plotted, and it has no ending. It just stops, because the filmmaker shot a third picture simultaneously and decided to leave you hanging. Its predecessor started like gangbusters, but lost its rudder. This one doesn't pretend to be much more than a collection of swashbuckling set pieces with the hustle of a vaudeville show. You need to have seen the first picture to get the in-jokes. Dead Man's Chest doesn't bother to reintroduce anyone. The loopy independent operator Sparrow is dubbed a dying breed in an ever smaller world by a shifty lord who takes his cues from the East India Trading Company, a multinational corporation using the military to deliver massive profits to itself. The central couple is once again Will Turner, played by Orlando Bloom, and Elizabeth Swann, played by Keira Knightley, who find their nuptials postponed by imprisonment for treason. Will must track down Jack Sparrow and obtain a certain compass. Why, I can't tell you. It's a MacGuffin. More important are the characters he meets along the way, zany cannibals, a giant sea urchin, and half-man, half-fish pirate phantoms formed of soil and seaweed and parts of crustaceans and mollusks. The captain of the fishmen is Davy Jones, of Davy Jones's locker fame, a mean, mandibled squid man, a special effect with the hoary snarl of Bill Nighy, whose voice is recognizable by his trademark little snort. Here he makes a deal with Depp Sparrow in exchange for the return of Sparrow's soul.
Have you not met Will Turner? He's a noble, heroic, terrific soprano. Worth at least four, maybe three and a half. And did I happen to mention he's in love with a girl? Due to be married, betrothed. Dividing him from her and her from him would only be half as cruel as actually allowing them to be joined in holy matrimony. Aye.
I keep the boy 99 souls. But I wonder, Sparrow, can you live with this? Can you condemn an innocent man, a friend, to a lifetime of solitude in your name while you roam free?
Yep, I'm good with it. Shall we seal it in blood? I mean, ink.
The director, Gore Verbinski, has grown more adept at Spielberg-style action, in which the fun is as much in the elegance of the staging as the stunts. A fight atop a big rolling wheel has so many variables it's like a great Newtonian physics joke. Orlando Bloom is a study in blandness, but he's largely a straight man for the rest of the oddballs, including Knightley, whose big, thrusting jaw takes her out of the insipid ingenue class. As Elizabeth Swann, she's like some kind of iron-willed fish person herself, only lovely enough for a bejeweled tank. Dead Man's Chest comes down to a duel between the Swan and the Sparrow, and Knightley has so much gumption as she stares down Johnny Depp that, well, who knows, she might one day be eligible for the Sons of Brando Club herself.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, filmmaker Richard Linklater. His new film, A Scanner Darkly, about drug addiction, paranoia, and government surveillance, is based on a novel by Philip K. Dick and stars Robert Downey Jr. and Keanu Reeves. Linklater also made the films The School of Rock and Dazed and Confused. Join us for the next Fresh Air.